Bueno, buenos días. Empezamos la segunda sesión de este workshop PUC Río, Universidad de Girona, sobre responsabilidad. Sin más presentaciones, hoy empezamos con la sesión a cargo de Noel Stuchiner, de la Pontificia Universidad Católica Río de Janeiro. Y a cargo de la contraponencia estará Sebastián Figueroa, que desde hace unos meses está también incorporado a nuestra universidad en Girona. El régimen será como lo que hicimos ayer, 40 minutos, unos minutos, 10-15 minutos para Sebastián, respuesta y abrimos el debate. Bienvenido, Noel.
Bom, como não poderia deixar de ser, eu começo agradecendo pela hospitalidade incrível com a qual nós sempre somos recebidos. Já é a segunda vez que nós estamos aqui. O grupo de Girona já esteve no Rio uma vez e sempre as trocas foram fantásticas. Eu pensei em fazer a minha apresentação em catalão, mas como o Sebastião é chileno e está aqui só há poucos meses, eu achei que não seria justo com o Sebastião, então eu vou fazer a minha apresentação em inglês para facilitar a compreensão. O título, the title of my paper is Tossing Around Intuitions About Tossing Dwarfs Around. It is an attempt to do some work in experimental philosophy of law, my first attempt to do some work in experimental philosophy of law, and it's still a work in progress. We're still undergoing the experiments, so as of yet, I'm still not committed to everything that I say on the paper that I handed to you. Sí. My main aim is to investigate whether legal decision-making is subject to certain paradoxes, more specifically to the abstract and concrete paradox and to the paradox of order effects. And here I'll be investigating more specifically the principle of human dignity and trying to see if the principle of human dignity is subject to these paradoxes. In order to start out my presentation, I would like to borrow and adapt an analogy that was used by Joshua Green. Maybe some of you are familiar with Joshua Green's work. He works in the psychology department at Harvard and talks about the trolley dilemmas and things like that. And he has been presenting an analogy in his talks, and it's the camera analogy. And the camera analogy goes somewhat like this. He uses the camera analogy in order to explain how we make judgments in general. More specifically, he uses the camera analogy in order to explain how we make moral judgments. And even more particularly, he uses the camera analogy in order to explain his dual process theory of moral judgment. I will not use the analogy in exactly the same way as he's using it, but I will adapt it in order to explain legal decision making. So the analogy goes like this. He asks us to think about a sophisticated camera. These contemporary sophisticated cameras that have a lot of automatic settings in them. And usually people buy these cameras because these cameras make their life easier. If you want to take a picture of Diego, you put the camera on portrait mode and you take a picture of Diego. If you want to take a picture of the mountains, you put the picture in landscape mode and you take a picture of the mountain. If you are in Rio de Janeiro in the final of the World Cup and Brazil is playing against Spain, and you want to take a picture of the match, you put the automatic setting in sports mode, and you'll take a pretty decent picture of the game. So these sophisticated cameras that have these automatic settings that are present, and they make life easier for the photographer, especially for the photographer who is not very skilled at taking pictures. But there are situations that will show up that were not anticipated by the manufacturer of the camera, right? And so for these situations, the automatic settings, they will not work. There are also cases that might show up that were anticipated by the manufacturer of the camera, but because you think you're a very skilled photographer, you would do much better if you were able to have the liberty to set up the camera your own way. So, gladly, these cameras don't just have automatic settings. They also have a manual mode, right? So, on the second picture, we see the camera set on the manual mode, right? And you can use the manual mode, and in the manual mode, you have the flexibility to take the picture the way you think is more fit or more adequate. So if you want to do something fancy with the photograph, if you want to take a photograph of a case that was not anticipated by the manufacturer of the camera, you put the camera on manual mode, and then you do all the setting up of the light and everything else. And according to Joshua Green, this is pretty much how we make judgments, and specifically that's how we make moral judgments. Sometimes we make moral judgments by making use of automatic settings. We have quick automatic reactions to certain situations and we make a moral judgment. And sometimes we shut off the automatic settings and make decisions based on the manual mode. And Joshua Green says that this is very interesting, or this is very beneficial, because it allows the photographer or the moral decision maker to travel the ubiquitous design trade-off between flexibility and efficiency, right? With the automatic settings, you have efficiency. With the manual mode, you have flexibility. And my objective is to use this analogy to explain legal decision making. I think that the law in contemporary democratic constitutional systems is built very much like the camera that Joshua Green has in mind. We have automatic settings, we have rules, but we can also do away with the results generated by the rules with the manual mode of law, which are constitutionally, morally loaded principles, principles that are framed in a moral wording that allow for the shutting off of the automatic settings. And I think that one of law's aim with this construction, with this design, is to allow for the judicial decision maker to achieve this equilibrium between flexibility and efficiency. An equilibrium that was noticed as very important by Hart in his concept of law, and Hart believes that this can be achieved by the open texture of law. One of the principal ways, one of the main ways by which we can do away with the rule-generated results is by making use of one specific principle, which is the principle of human dignity. The principle of human dignity seems to be one of the main trump cards for doing away with the rule-generated results. And what I will do next is try to give some evidence, at least some examples from Brazil, in which the principle of human dignity has been used as a trump card for rule-generated results. So in Brazil, the unified health system establishes through a rule-based mechanism what are the treatments, what are the medications, what are the medical procedures that should be covered by the government. And sometimes a person who is in need will go to the judiciary to claim a certain treatment or a certain medication or a certain procedure which is not anticipated or which is not established by the list that is furnished by the unified health system. So in 2004, the Superior Court of Justice, the STJ, in Brazil judged one of these cases. It was a person who had retinitis pigmentosa, which is a degenerative disease of the retina. The disease kills the photosensitive cells of the retina, and the person starts to see in a blurred way, and eventually the person becomes blind, and that's the picture of over there. And this person wanted to undergo a treatment that was only available in Cuba and was not anticipated by the unified health system. So this person asked for, went to the judiciary to ask for the government to pay for his treatment. And it's also interesting to say that he was relevant to say that he was also asking to go to this treatment and also take someone from his family to accompany him. And the money that would be spent would be a very high amount of money so that he could go to Cuba with a family member and undergo this treatment. So he went to the judiciary, and the judiciary asked for the opinion of the Ophthalmological Association of Brazil. And the Ophthalmological Association of Brazil gave their expert scientific opinion. And their expert scientific opinion was that this treatment should not be paid by the government. There was no evidence that this treatment would work. And actually, there was some evidence that it could be actually detrimental to the person who would undergo this treatment. So their view was that it should not be covered by the government. However, there were some decisions by the justices that really call our attention, and I'll just go over two of them. So this is Justice Delgado from the Superior Court of Justice, and this is his full decision. Believe it or not, this is what he had to say about the case. Mr. President, Eminent Justice of the Court, Articles 1, Items 2 and 3 of the Federal Constitution tell us that the fundamental aim, amongst others, of the Brazilian Federal Republic is to care for the human dignity and citizenship. There is no more significant way to protect human dignity or citizenship by the state than by providing all the necessary means to those who need help, such as in the case described, in an attempt to give a solution to the problem. I am not impressed with the scientific discussion that was brought up, since this is not what is at stake. What surprises me is that we have a citizen about to become blind, if not blind already, without the right to see the light, without the right to see the sun, that is, without vision, which is the minimal right of every citizen. And that was his complete decision for the case. And a second decision goes the following way. So this is Justice Fuchs. And it doesn't sound very good in English, I guess, but this is Justice Fuchs. And I'm sorry. But Justice Fuchs decided pretty much in the same way as Justice Delgado. His decision was a bit longer, and the reason his decision was a bit longer is because before actually saying what his decision was, he thanked God for the opportunity of being that tough spot, making such a delicate and important decision. And he spent maybe two or three sentences rejecting the expert opinion of the Ophthalmological Association of Brazil with the following argument, saying that under God, everyone is fallible. That is, the only being who is infallible is God, and therefore the Ophthalmological Association of Brazil could be wrong, and therefore we should not trust that much the opinion of the Ophthalmological Association of Brazil. And then he goes on to say, I am a perseverant squire, un escudero, perseverant squire of human dignity, of the escudero de la dignidad, of the immanent values of life and hope of the human being.
I believe this is our daily task as judges. So in doubt, we should judge in favor of keeping alive the hope that this citizen will be able to get cured in this advanced medical center. Once again, whenever torn between the dictates of the law and the demands of justice, I'll opt for the solution that I consider to be just. And this was pretty much his whole decision. So these are examples of human dignity working as trump cards of doing away with the rule-generated results. And I don't think this is a peculiarity of Brazil. And we see human dignity taking a central position in a lot of legal systems, both sovereign state legal systems and international legal systems. So Pedro, please.
So a picture of the Brazilian Constitution, the German Constitution, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Brazilian Constitution talks about dignity in article number 1. The German Constitution also has human dignity in article number 1. The Declaration of Human Rights also in article 1 talks about the importance of human dignity. And in Spain, and also there is human dignity shows up in Article 10, subsection 1, but it's the first article of the Bill of Rights. And so this is present in pretty much all legal systems, if not all legal systems that we see today. So. But to say that the principle of human dignity is present in all these different systems is not to say that there is agreement about what this principle consists in, and people do not share the same view of how this principle is to be applied. And curiously, Michael Rosen, who is also a professor at Harvard University, he just wrote a book on human dignity that came out in 2012. And to illustrate some of the difficulties with the idea of dignity, he starts with a case that happened in Brazil. And this was the case of Geise Arruda, which is the girl pictured in the top photograph. What happened was that this girl, I can't remember the exact year in which this happened, but she went to the university. She was a tourism student at Bandeirante University in São Paulo. And she went to class wearing a very short pink dress. And she was very much insulted that way by a lot of her colleagues from the university. And what ended up happening was that, at least in one moment of the story, what ended up happening was that she was actually expelled from the university because she did not respect the demands of morality and the demands of academic dignity. Of course, she hired a lawyer. The lawyer filed suit against the university, and she won 40,000 reais, which is about $20,000, because the judiciary found that her dignity was trampled and not academic dignity that was jeopardized. And so that's, so on the top picture, we have a picture of Geise Arruda and the dress that she was wearing. On this picture, we have her being taken out of the class by the police. And actually, in this case, she was taken out for her own protection because people, they were afraid that people could actually hurt her that day. But I'm using the picture to show that she was expelled from the university and because the way she was dressing was harming dignity. And this is a protest because people thought that Geise Arruda was having her dignity being hurt, being jeopardized by the decision of the university. So these disagreements concerning the way to use and to apply dignity led some philosophers to take a skeptical stance towards the concept of dignity. And I think one prominent view that characterizes the skepticism is what Schopenhauer has to say. And what Schopenhauer has to say is the following. That expression, dignity of man, once uttered by Kant,
afterward became the shibboleth of all perplexed and empty-headed moralists who concealed behind that imposing expression their lack of any real basis for morals, or at any rate of one that had any meaning. They cunningly counted on the fact that readers would be glad to see themselves invested with such a dignity and would accordingly be quite satisfied with it. So we have to ask ourselves if Schopenhauer is right. Is the concept of dignity an empty concept? How do we go about trying to grasp or understand the meaning of dignity? And Michael Rosen has a proposal of the way we should go about trying to investigate the meaning of dignity and the concept of dignity and trying to untangle this concept, which is very contested. And he says the following: to untangle the idea of dignity, the best way, I think, is to reach back to its roots. And these, like all concepts of significant interest in political life, are historical. And I don't think that, for my purposes, the best way is to investigate the history of the concept. So Pedro, please, I think that in order to understand how the concept is actually applied, to understand the meaning as applied, the meaning as used, we are better off using the methods of experimental philosophy and the methods of social psychology. And that was the symbol that a lot of people used for experimental philosophy when the movement just started to come up, which is the burning armchair, the idea that the philosopher should leave the armchair and do experiments. Actually, now I think that that this symbol is a little bit too radical, and I think that that a lot of experimental philosophers would be satisfied with an armchair with wheels, the idea that you still keep conceptual analysis, you use conceptual analysis to design the experiment, you use conceptual analysis after you have the results from the experiments, so you don't leave the armchair, but you should look at empirical data and you should not leave this information out of the research. So, just getting back at my main point was to see if the principle of human dignity is subject to certain paradoxes, to the paradox of the abstract and the concrete, and to the paradox of order effects. So I will give a few past examples of these paradoxes. It's not a paradox in the logical strict sense. It's a paradox more in the colloquial or the ordinary sense that they generate inconsistent beliefs, but not necessarily logically inconsistent beliefs. And I'm not going to dwell theoretically on the concept, on the different paradoxes, trying to explain why they happen and things like that. But I'll give a few examples, and I think with these examples you'll get a good taste of what these paradoxes, how these paradoxes are created. So this was a case that was proposed by Sean Nichols and Joshua Knobe, and they described a universe that would be a deterministic universe when everything that was generated was generated due to some cause that was previously determined by something else. And then they described this universe, and then they asked people a couple of questions. And these were the questions that they asked. In universe A, is it possible for a person to be fully morally responsible for their actions? So this was the question that they took to be the abstract question, right? Yes or no? In this condition, most subjects, 86%, gave the incompatibilist response. They said that it was not possible for somebody in this universe, this deterministic universe, to be responsible for his actions. But in the concrete case, they describe a specific action that was taken by a person. And they say, in universe A, a man named Bill has become attracted to his secretary, and he decides that the only way to be with her is to kill his wife
and 3 children.
He knows that it is impossible to escape from his house in the event of a fire. Before he leaves on a business trip, he sets up a device in his basement that burns down the house
and kills his family.
Is Bill fully responsible for killing his wife and children?
Yes or no?
And in this case, most of the subjects, 72%,
gave the compatibilist response.
In another case,
the abstract and concrete was created by making the situation happen in an alternate universe, that was the abstract case, or happening in our universe, and that was the way to make the case more concrete.
And in the actual condition, there was this was the question that was presented. Many eminent scientists have become convinced that every decision a person makes is completely caused by what happened before the decision. Given the past, each decision has to happen the way that it does. These scientists think that a person's decision is always an inevitable result of their genetic makeup combined with environmental influences. So if a person decides to commit a crime, this can always be explained as a result of past influences. Any individual who had the same genetic makeup and the same environmental influences would have decided exactly the same thing. This is because a person's decision is always completely caused by what happened in the past.
And then in this concrete condition, they ask if a person should be responsible for his actions. And people will say that in the concrete condition, he should be responsible, but in the alternate condition, which is the same thing happening in an alternate universe, that the person should not be held responsible for his actions. And finally, a last example is an example that's discussed by Slovak, and it reveals what he calls the identifiable victim effect. And Slovak talks about situations of donating money to the poor, right? And he compares how showing people a description of the poor country will affect the donations, and how showing a picture of a specific poor person in that country will affect the donations. And when we give statistical data, when we describe the situation of the country, which is the abstract scenario, which is the abstract vignette, we see that people's donations are much less than when we show a specific person and we give information about that specific person and we show a photograph of that person. Now, concerning order effects. Eric Schwitzgebel, it's a hard name to pronounce, and Fiery Cushman, they have a paper in which they show that that order effects also influence the way people make judgments. And in their case, it's very significant because they show that experts in philosophy, actually experts in ethical philosophy, will have their conceptions or their judgments modified by the order in which cases are presented to them. So he used the famous trolley examples. He gave people either the bystander case or the push example, and I'll not have time to go into these, but it was on the paper, and I think, maybe not on the paper, but I think you're all familiar with this. And so when philosophers, experts in ethics, first get the bystander case, and then they get the push scenario, they have different intuitions and they have different responses about how these cases should be resolved. They think that they usually have consequentialist intuitions regarding the bystander case, but they have what Joshua Green calls deontological intuitions regarding the second case, right? But if you change the order in which the cases are presented, if you give experts in ethics first the push scenario and then the bystander scenario, then they tend to respond to both cases in the same way, both deontologically. They see the push case and they say no, and they see the bystander case and they say no, the person should not push the lever. And curiously, they go into what Fiery Cushman, and Fiery Cushman is a person that I have to thank because he helped me think a lot about my problems because I worked with him in Brown University for a short while. Of course, all the mistakes are my responsibility, but he helped me think about some of the problems here. And then what Cushman says is that, and Schwitzbogel says, is that philosophers go into confabulation. Philosophers who get this case, they will not adopt the principle of double effect, while philosophers who receive the first order of cases, they will adopt the principle of double effect in order to explain. So it's very much contingent. It depends in the order in which they get the questions and which they get the vignettes. Right? The principles, the philosophical principles they endorse depends on the order in which they get the questions. So my idea was to test this, and I wanted to use a real case. I mean, I don't have anything against the fruit fly examples that are used by philosophers, but philosophers are frequently attacked for using examples that don't occur in the real world. But in law, we have a lot of examples that can be used and that actually occurred, and then we cannot be charged for using examples that no one is actually interested in or that are examples that are too far-fetched to ever happen, right? So I decided to use the dwarf tossing case, which probably all of you are familiar with, so just a very short description of the dwarf tossing case. So this happened in 1991 in France. There was a little person, I guess that's the politically, I just found out that maybe this is the politically correct way to talk about dwarves, and a little person was being tossed. The name of the little person was Manuel Weichenhamm, and he was being tossed in a bar because dwarf tossing was an activity that happened in a lot of bars in France, and he was being tossed. It was a way for the people who went to the bar to have some fun. They would make different teams, and the teams would compete to see who could toss the dwarf the furthest, and the person who could toss the dwarf the furthest, or the team who could toss the dwarf the furthest, would win a prize or something else, or just would be declared the champion. And this was Manuel's profession, right? And he said that it was his profession that that gave him the wages so that he could live with dignity. And he said he liked this profession. And he used a protective apparel so that he wouldn't get hurt. So he would wear a helmet, and he would wear protections on his body. And so it was not a dangerous activity, apparently. And he liked participating in the activity. And he actually said that his profession and the money that he got with his profession allowed him to live with dignity. But the mayor of Mont-Saint-Sur-Orge, where this activity was held, he didn't agree with the activity because he said that throwing dwarfs could jeopardize the little person's dignity. So the case was taken to the administrative court of Versailles, and eventually the case ended up on the Conseil d'État, which is the highest administrative court in France, and the highest administrative court in France decided that that the mayor was right and that the activity was harmful, or that it jeopardized the dignity of the dwarf, and that it should be prohibited and it should not be held. So we used this case as the blueprint for the design of our experiment. So very quickly, this is what we did. First, we gave people abstract scenarios. We gave people, so this is still a pilot study, and the results are not really to be trusted that much. And we're still learning the best way to frame the question and to prepare the experiment and the design of the experiment. But what we did was give some people an abstract case. And just to illustrate, I'll read the vignette that we presented to people. Because it was originally prepared in the U.S., we used the vignettes that I thought up in the U.S., but it was actually applied in Portugal and in Portuguese. In the U.S., some bars hold a dwarf dosing competition. So this is the abstract case. A dwarf hired by the bar owner wearing protective apparel, which guarantees personal safety, will allow himself to be tossed by two teams and will get well paid for his activity. The team that tosses him the furthest will win the competition and a free round of beer. This seems to liven up the place. People will laugh, and bars that have this will always be full. On a scale of 1 to 6, how much will the dwarf who chooses to be the object of this activity be jeopardizing his dignity? So this was the abstract case. And in the concrete case, we used some of the strategies that were used in these past examples that I described to you. We gave a name to the dwarf, we described his medical condition, and we also made abstract cases of a person, and then we gave a name to, in the concrete condition, we gave a name to the person, and we also had an abstract case of bars that held a model tossing competition. We framed questions in the abstract, and in the concrete situations, we would say that the model was a blonde hair, tall man, or something like that. And so, Pedro, so we have abstract and we have concrete scenarios. An abstract person scenario, a concrete person scenario, an abstract dwarf scenario, a concrete dwarf scenario, an abstract model scenario, a concrete model vignette. And we also tested order effects. So maybe you can go through all of the slides. We changed the order, both in the abstract and in the concrete, to see how that would affect people's judgments. So first dwarf, model, then person. Then we tried all the different possible orders. So just very quickly, what were some of the results? The results were that we did find some asymmetries. And again, these results are not to be trusted because it's still the pilot study. It's still very informal, but it suggests that it's worth investigating further. And what we find is that people in the concrete cases, at least in the person case and the dwarf case, people seem to think that the dwarf's dignity was jeopardized more in the concrete than the abstract. Curiously, in the model case, we see the opposite happening. In the abstract case, people think that his dignity is highly jeopardized, but in the concrete case, we see a complete asymmetry and a significant asymmetry. People think that his dignity is not jeopardized at all, and in the question and answers, maybe I can talk about some of the hypotheses why this occurred. And we also saw some effects in order, some order effects happening, and the dwarf case seems to be an attenuator for the other cases, and I still haven't given much thought to the order effect cases. So what are the implications of this for legal theory? The implications for descriptive legal theory are obvious. I mean, judges sometimes judge the constitutionality of a case in the abstract. Sometimes judges judge the constitutionality of a case in a more concrete fashion, right? Leading with a particular case that is described. Sometimes they will judge the constitutionality of a norm in the abstract. Sometimes they will judge the constitutionality of a norm as applied to a specific case. Sometimes judges will receive precedents in different orders. So this is very important for descriptive legal theory and for, legal argumentation theory. But some people think that the main trait of philosophy is to be normative, right? A lot of people think that real philosophy is normative philosophy. They think that, I think that philosophy is as much in the description business as it is in the prescription or the normative business. But some people think that what is essentially philosophy is to make normative contributions. And for these people, I have to say, what are the normative implications of finding these asymmetries? And I think there, the implications of this for normative legal adjudication theory. And in as much as there are some normative legal adjudication theories that invite or request that judges use the manual mode in a frequent way, and I think there are theories that are more inviting to this kind of attitude, and in Brazil, legal theorists who defend a particularist view of adjudication, they usually call upon Alexei and Dworkin to defend this view. They think that judges should be using the manual mode whenever rules get in the way to the correct result. So, Pedro, please. So these normative adjudication models that are inviting to the manual mode have been called in the legal theory literature particularist models of decision making. Particularist models of decision making have been nicknamed by Frederick Schauer and by Larry Alexander as Spike Lee models of decision making, because ultimately what they claim is that judges do the right thing. Right, so we have the picture of the do the right thing film over there. But if they claim that, if the particularist models claim that judges should be putting the law in the manual mode all the time, then we have to take into consideration how they decide when they put the law in manual mode. How are the judgments that they come up with when they put the law in manual mode? And I think we have good reason to think that judges are very inconsistent when they use the law in manual mode. And they probably don't realize that they are being that much inconsistent when they put the law in manual mode. And they don't realize what is affecting and what is generating all this inconsistency. So, Pedro. So if we have good reason to think that the Spike Lee model will turn into what I call the Sinatra model, which is the I did it my way model, even if my way is the dead inconsistent way model, then we have good reason perhaps to suggest that the law should not be put in the manual mode so often. And just to conclude, and not to take any longer, I'll read the conclusion from the paper. That human dignity is a highly disputed concept is something everyone knows already. We bring nothing new to the table by recognizing that there are profound disagreements concerning its use among different people. To be clear, to say that its use is disputed is not yet to assert that it has no meaning, but that people attribute different meanings to it. Regardless of what meaning is correct or not, and I don't want to go there, it would be more surprising to find out that the same people apply the principle in inconsistent fashion. This is exactly what was done here. What this research is trying to show by testing the susceptibility of the application of the principle of human dignity to the abstract and concrete paradox and to order effects is that there is not only intersubjective disagreement, but that intrasubjective inconsistencies are also present. Intra-individual inconsistencies are more pernicious. The pervasive presence of disagreements, not only amongst different people, but also inside the same subject, does call into question the very possibility of giving meaning to the concept. It seems that it is not just a case of having many meanings, but of the concept having any meaning at all. Additionally, the factors that seem to influence the application of the principle, the level of abstractness or concreteness, or the order effects in which cases are presented, appear to be morally irrelevant. In sum, if judges are not as consistent as we believe they are or should be, then we need to take the question of whether they should be changing from automatic to manual mode, then we need to retake the question of whether they should be changing from automatic to manual mode so often. So if we are correct about what our experiment is saying, then I guess in the end we can make Schopenhauer smile. Okay, thank you.
Bueno, hola. Gracias por la invitación, Yana. Hola. Gracias, Yana, por la invitación, Adrián. Sí. Le agradezco la confianza. Yo soy un recién llegado para comentar un trabajo tan bueno como el de Noel. Sí. Lo que voy a comentar, básicamente, yo lo considero algunas especulaciones, más que convicciones, sobre cómo enfrentar algunas de las cosas que nos propone Noel. Y lo veo como ciertas ideas complementarias que pueden ayudar a, tal vez a clarificar, espero, si no ponerlas en la discusión, ¿cierto? Estas cuestiones que ocurren con el concepto de dignidad, ¿cierto? Y con el modo en que queremos entender y enfrentar la forma en que los jueces deciden y cómo diseñamos nuestras instituciones, ¿cierto? Entonces, lo que quiero hacer es hacer algunas lecturas en torno a estos dos problemas que mostró Noel, ¿cierto? El de el desacuerdo intersubjetivo, ¿sí? Y la inconsistencia intrasubjetiva, ¿sí? al momento de usar el concepto de el término dignidad, ¿sí? Yo entonces son dos cosas básicamente las que haré. En primer lugar, trataré de ubicar el uso de este término, hablar un poco de ¿cuál es el contexto en el que parece ser que las discusiones tratadas en estos juicios, ¿sí?, tienen sentido? ¿Y cuáles son las implicancias del contexto en el cual el uso del término, ¿sí?, se vuelve problemático? En este sentido, tal vez me voy a acercar más al trabajo de Rosen, ¿sí?, y por eso tal vez puede ser complementario. Para esto seguiré alguna idea de Tugendhat. Y en segundo lugar, haré algunas, si bien no conozco mucho filosofía experimental, algunas cosas que me llamaron la atención y que pueden servir para discutir especialmente el caso que, como ustedes lo trabajan. Bueno, lo primero, el ámbito de la dignidad, como les dije. ¿Sí? Bueno, acá voy a tomar algunas cosas que Noel señaló, ¿cierto? Pareciera ser que la noción de dignidad, ¿sí?, se vuelve problemática al cumplir ciertos roles importantes en documentos que también consideramos políticamente importantes, ¿sí? Adelanto que lo que yo creo que el lugar donde se discute tal vez la dignidad es un lugar más relacionado con la política, con cuestiones de justicia distributiva, etcétera, ¿sí?, más que tal vez cuestiones puramente morales. Es difícil hacer la distinción entre las dos cosas, estoy de acuerdo, tal vez eso lo podríamos discutir, ¿sí? Los artículos que señaló Noel, si ustedes se fijan, siempre es el primer artículo y están los preámbulos de las declaraciones, etcétera, y el rol que cumple es cómo el Estado, la comunidad internacional, etcétera, se compromete a proteger la dignidad humana, ¿sí? Y esto también lo vemos en los discursos de los jueces, es decir, yo soy un escudero de la dignidad, ¿sí?, y, etcétera. Esto creo que hay que relacionarlo con tres cosas de lo que ocurre desde el año 49, digamos, ¿cierto? El 48 con la Declaración Universal de Derechos Humanos, la Constitución Alemana, etcétera. ¿Qué pasa en los últimos 70 años? Bueno, en primer lugar, este rol importante la muestra como lo que, parafraseando la Acta de Independencia norteamericana, ¿cierto?, como una verdad autoevidente, es decir, como es algo valioso, es algo que hay que cuidar, ¿sí? Parece ser que todos estamos de acuerdo en eso, ¿sí? Sí, o sea, eran mismos tratados de derechos humanos creados en la Guerra Fría entre concepciones totalmente distintas del mundo, ¿cierto? Acordaban que la dignidad humana estaba ahí primero. Entonces, esa es una cuestión interesante. Ahora, el segundo punto está relacionado con esto, es decir, todos los que decimos que tiene que estar ese término en ese lugar, ¿sí?, no compartimos necesariamente una concepción del mundo común. Y aquí yo podría decir, incluso tenemos ideologías distintas, ¿sí? O también podríamos discutir qué es una ideología, pero acá yo asumiré, por ejemplo, supone una concepción completa del mundo una ideología, ¿cierto? Supone un compromiso emocional con ciertas verdades evidentes, entre ellas la dignidad humana que compartiríamos, ¿cierto? y tienden a ser, esto es interesante, en general, resistente a las acusaciones de inconsistencia, estas visiones. ¿Sí? El tercer punto, ¿sí?, es que, al tener una carga emotiva, tiende a cumplir el rol de una razón última en nuestros razonamientos. ¿Sí? Es decir, como podríamos decir, donde cuando estamos cavando con las razones, donde la pala topa, ¿cierto? Es decir, yo puedo aducir a la dignidad humana y todo, hay algo, hay ruido ahí importante y nos vamos a ir más allá, ¿cierto? Y en el contexto histórico, ¿sí?, que esto lo tomo de Tugendhat, ¿sí?, este desarrollo y estas discusiones se dan, bueno, después de la discusión de, presentada después del libro de John Rawls, ¿cierto?, Teoría de la Justicia, donde se empiezan a hacer muchas críticas a la forma tradicional de leer la justicia, ya sea desde el feminismo, multiculturalismo, etc. ¿Sí? Entonces, lo que va a decir Tugendhat es que el rol que usualmente ocupaba la libertad en estos discursos, en las constituciones, etc., empieza a ocuparlo la dignidad humana. ¿Sí? Y se lee de la manera que podríamos decir cómo entendemos lo que significa vivir una vida digna, cuáles son las condiciones para tener una vida digna de ser vivida. ¿Sí? Esto también lo toma Amartya Sen, Nussbaum, etc. Y gran parte de la teoría de los derechos humanos asume esta idea. ¿Sí? Entonces es interesante porque abarca, ¿cierto?, este término, en el rol que le damos importante, ¿cierto?, abarca una cantidad de, digamos, de ideologías distintas, ¿cierto?, que lo toman para sí. Entonces, este es como el ámbito que yo creo que lo vemos, ¿cierto? Entonces, yo diría que, por una parte tenemos, ¿cierto?, el término común, en un lugar valioso donde todos creemos que debe estar. ¿Sí? Por otra parte, tenemos concepciones muy distintas. ¿Sí? Por ejemplo, un juez católico, ¿cierto?, lo puede utilizar, uno liberal, etc. Y las discusiones se dan, ¿cierto?, y todos como escuderos. Finalmente, él lo explicita, pero tal vez todos dicen yo soy escudero de la dignidad. ¿Cierto? Esto es interesante porque, bueno, y la otra consecuencia para sumarla después es que cuando discutimos esto, la estamos usando en términos de cuál es la relación del individuo con la comunidad, ¿cierto?, en términos de justicia distributiva. Esto es interesante porque si vemos los casos, ¿cierto? El primer caso era si un medicamento, ¿cierto? Si, por ejemplo, la prestación de medicamentos tenía que limitarse a la lista, ¿cierto?, hecha por unos especialistas, o también hay que considerar el resguardo de la salud de determinado individuo a pesar de que no esté en la lista. ¿Entiendes? O sea, es una cuestión de protección de la salud del individuo, por ejemplo, ¿cierto? Y si uno ve los fallos, ¿cierto? Finalmente eso es lo que está, ¿cierto? Dicen, la mejor manera de proteger la dignidad humana, ¿cierto?, por el Estado, ¿cierto?, es proveyendo todos los medios necesarios para el que necesita salud, ¿cierto? En el caso del lanzamiento de nanos, por lo menos como se plantea ante el Comité Internacional de Naciones Unidas, ¿sí?, el año 92, el país del 91, lo que aduce el Estado francés es que la dignidad humana es parte del orden público y lo que hace esa actividad es romper el orden público, ¿cierto? Entonces, hay una noción de dignidad humana, ¿cierto?, con la noción de orden público, mientras que, por otra parte, se aducía, por ejemplo, libertad de trabajo o la misma autonomía de la voluntad, ¿cierto? Entonces, lo que quiero decir con esto es que tenemos un mismo término, pero tenemos conceptos muy distintos, ¿sí? Y esto yo creo que, por lo menos, tal vez no en tanto la exposición, pero sí en algunas cosas que planteas en el trabajo. ¿Sí? Tenemos como, podríamos como ahí empezar a tener un desacuerdo. En el primer párrafo tú dices, ¿sí?, si el significado de un concepto está dado por su uso, ¿cierto?, y su uso es inconsistente, entonces podemos afirmar que significado es también inconsistente. A mí me da la impresión de que más que un significado inconsistente, ¿sí?, o sea, podríamos decir que el término que utilizamos lo utilizamos con distintos conceptos, ¿sí?, teniendo en cuenta distintos conceptos. ¿Sí? Esto es bastante común, usar un mismo término pero con distintos conceptos. El tema es que como estamos en discusiones, en un ámbito de discusión, ¿cierto?, agitado, etcétera, pareciera ser que podemos creer, caer bajo la ilusión de que estamos hablando de una misma cuestión, un mismo concepto, y este concepto tiene problemas. Pero en realidad, lo que yo creo es que tenemos distintos conceptos para un mismo término. Y por eso distintos conceptos para un mismo término. ¿Sí? Y por eso, cuando vemos otro argumento que tú das, ¿cierto? Que en determinados juicios o en determinados casos, el utilizar el término dignidad humana puede servir para ambos bandos. ¿Sí? Esto no es necesariamente conflictivo, pero tal vez es otra explicación para utilizarlo. Entonces, uno podría explicar la inconsistencia intrasubjetiva, ¿cierto? De un modo político, como yo tengo el estándar de la humanidad, ¿cierto? Y por ende puedo enfrentar este caso, por ejemplo, diciendo que el orden público está primero, diciendo que en realidad la concepción del ser humano parte del individuo libre, etcétera, etcétera. ¿Sí? Ahora, el tema de las inconsistencias individuales. ¿Sí? Esto, yo creo que así uno puede explicar, ¿cierto? La idea del desacuerdo intersubjetivo. Ya. Cuando uno ve cómo se enfrenta el caso, ¿sí? Me da la impresión de que el ejemplo utilizado apela más, cuando habla de violentar la dignidad de la persona, ¿cierto? Apela más a la idea kantiana, de la que habla Schopenhauer, ¿cierto? De la idea del individuo como fin en sí mismo, etc. ¿Sí? Es decir, se pregunta si la decisión del individuo violenta su propia dignidad. Ese es un poco el fin de la pregunta. Y ahí uno podría decir que si tratamos eso, en este tipo de casos, para explicar este tipo de discusión del que yo hablé, concediéndome que es el ámbito de la discusión, ¿cierto? Podríamos decir que hay un problema. Porque el caso no discute tal vez lo que sí se discute cuando estamos en estos juicios, ¿sí? Cuestiones de justicia distributiva, relación sujeto-comunidad, etc. Esa es como una primera cuestión de, tal vez el caso se podría revisar en términos del ámbito de la discusión, si es que es así. Ya. La segunda cuestión que tengo con el caso, y esto sí, es otra cosa, y está relacionada con la metodología, etc., ¿cierto? Me voy a centrar más que nada en la discusión de la paradoja concreto abstracto. ¿Sí? Conozco un poco más y en el texto me parece que estaba más desarrollado ese caso. ¿Sí? En el texto. ¿Por qué? Porque es interesante cómo determinar, ¿cierto? Por eso, esto ya es otra cosa, cómo determinar cuándo hay una relación concreto abstracto, ¿cierto? Y cuándo hay fidelidad entre la relación, digamos una relación interna entre el tipo y la instancia. ¿Sí? ¿Por qué? Porque si en una descripción de algo concreto, yo incluyo otro tipo de consideraciones, ¿cierto? Que pueden influenciar en los compromisos que yo asumo cuando lo leo y cuando lo juzgo, ¿cierto? Podemos decir que en realidad no estamos juzgando el mismo caso, ¿cierto? Esto, ¿cierto? Comentamos, ¿cierto? Por ejemplo, me llamó la atención un paper de Mandelbaum y Ripley, ¿sí? Que analizan este tema en los casos de Knob y Nicholson, etc. ¿Se acuerdan del primer caso que mostró Noel de la paradoja concreto abstracto que señalaba que en un primer caso explicamos que el mundo está causalmente determinado y si la en términos generales, ¿cierto? Y si los actos de las personas en este mundo causalmente determinado son responsables las personas de los actos cometidos ahí, ¿cierto? Y la respuesta pareciera ser que no. Luego, cuando nos ponen en un caso concreto, hablan de un caso de una persona que, por ejemplo, mata a su familia, ¿cierto?, para escaparse con su amante. Entonces la pregunta es, en ese caso, ¿cierto?, en el mismo mundo, causalmente determinado, etcétera, solamente que en un caso concreto, ¿consideramos o no responsable a la persona? Y la respuesta es generalmente sí. ¿Sí? Lo que señalan un poco estas dos personas, Ripley y Mandelson, es que ese tipo de casos, el enfrentar así los ejemplos, ¿sí?, no es, digamos, inocente. En términos de que cuando estamos en el momento, en lo concreto, ¿cierto?, parecía ser que hay otras intuiciones o cuestiones de la psicología folk, ¿cierto?, en juego. Por ejemplo, que cada vez que ocurre un daño, lo que hablábamos ayer, ¿cierto?, esperamos buscar una responsabilidad, más allá de si el mundo está determinado o no, por ejemplo, ¿cierto? Entonces, atribuimos responsabilidad. O, por ejemplo, que si ellos señalan, imagínense que cambiemos el caso a una descripción detallada de cómo la persona, yo muevo el brazo, ¿cierto?, enervo mis músculos, etcétera, para digerir agua. Entonces, en esa descripción tal vez dirían, ahí sí hay determinación causal, ¿cierto? Es decir, ¿por qué? Porque la explicación es, las expectativas que tengo cuando me enfrento a un concepto, ¿cierto?, son distintas dependiendo de cuál es el momento, cuál es, cómo se describe la cuestión, ¿cierto? Y esto, o sea, esto está discutido acá, pero ya llamaba la atención esto Anscombe y Davidson cuando hablaban de descripción de acciones, ¿cierto? Usar ciertos verbos, usar ciertas palabras para describir una acción, ¿cierto? La puede convertir directamente en intencional, ¿cierto? Con C, y tiene efectos intencionales con S en el momento de querer, ¿cierto? Hacer distintas descripciones. Entonces quería llamar la atención sobre eso en este tipo de experimentos, ¿sí? Y por último, para las consecuencias para la teoría legal, ¿cierto? Acá es mucho más especulativo todo lo que diré, mucho más aún. Si tomamos en serio esta posibilidad, ¿cierto? De que la descripción hay que hacerla con cuidado ya en casos en que al momento de concretizar en realidad no estamos comprometiendo con cosas distintas, ¿sí? Si podemos, por ejemplo, estudiar bien cada caso y ver que cuando describimos más concreto nos comprometemos a cosas diferentes, tal vez el particularismo ahí tendría un punto a favor, en el sentido de yo puedo ser sensible ante estas diferencias. ¿Sí? Y si yo puedo explicitarlas, ¿sí? Yo puedo explicitar diferencias, tal vez yo puedo tener una teoría de la adjudicación mejor. ¿Sí? Entonces, me refiero a que hay que tener cuidado con, por ejemplo, los resultados del experimento, porque si vemos que, como señalaste, que por lo menos en lo que va el experimento, cuando hablamos de nano y de persona en sentido genérico, ¿cierto? Cuando hablamos de modelo, las consecuencias son distintas, tal vez hay algo distinto en apelar a un modelo, en apelar a la descripción específica, etc. ¿Sí? Y si podemos, y si tal vez tenemos un aparataje teórico que lo permita, que permita dar cuenta de esas diferencias, ¿cierto? Tal vez un particularista tendría un punto, a favor, más que en contra. ¿Sí? En el sentido de que puedo dar cuenta de diferencias relevantes, que cambian los juicios de todas las personas. Por otra parte, me llama la atención, ¿cierto?, que, por ejemplo, bueno, los que litigan y los que no litigan, los que ven La Ley y el Orden, etcétera, ¿cierto?, y ven toda esta serie de televisión, es muy interesante ver que en muchos casos, y esto, cuando, en muchos casos donde pareciera ser que estamos todos de acuerdo con la aplicación de una norma específica, ¿cierto?, si el caso, un abogado lo presenta en una situación más concreta y otro lo presenta en una situación más abstracta, trae consecuencias diversas, ¿cierto?, está relacionado con lo que tú dices. Entonces, pareciera ser que incluso sin cambiar el modo de cámara podemos tener el problema. ¿Entiendes? O sea, tratando de ser fieles con las reglas, la descripción de la situación puede influenciar en cómo la utilizamos. ¿Sí? Bueno, eso lo, bueno, Shower y Alexander no tendrían problemas con eso, con la idea de la subinclusión. ¿Sí? Pero, pensando en un particularista, ¿cierto? Yo pensaba en Klaus Günther, que critica también las lecturas de Alexi y Dworkin, ¿cierto?, que plantea que en realidad no se trata de renunciar a las reglas nunca, sino de que el discurso de aplicación de una regla es distinto al de su validación y por ende, al momento de aplicar la norma, lo que tenemos que hacer es adecuar a las circunstancias, ¿cierto? Básicamente porque en el razonamiento, ¿cierto?, en la justificación interna, cuando dice, la norma dice, ¿cierto?, en el caso de X debe ser B, ¿cierto?, y se da X, en el que ¿cierto?, el supuesto fáctico, acá se los dejo además a todos los expertos en epistemología, etc. X no puede significar lo mismo en los dos casos. ¿Sí? ¿Por qué? Porque tenemos que hacer una descripción fáctica que no puede ser la misma que estuvo pensándose antes, ¿sí? Por varias cuestiones de que es imposible pensar todos los casos, etc. ¿Cierto? Esto es un poco con Hart. ¿Sí? Y por ende, hay que tener cuidado, a lo que refiero, hay que tener cuidado con las descripciones porque asumimos distintos compromisos en distintos momentos con lo que hacemos. ¿Sí? Entonces, el comentario tenía que ver con esas dos cosas. Con, en primer lugar, ver cuál es el ámbito de la discusión que sea la INEA y por qué yo creo que es un problema más bien ideológico y lo que complejiza su desacuerdo intersubjetivo, ¿cierto? Y cómo esto puede tener ciertas consecuencias para lo intrasubjetivo y tal vez cómo uno puede dar razón a favor de un particularismo si es que, ¿cierto?, asumiendo muchas cosas que yo asumí y especulando al respecto, ¿sí? Pero la idea era por eso, abrir discusión al respecto. Gracias. Ojalá se haya entendido.